Today is October 2nd, and this is the annual budget forum sponsored by the Tompkins County Legislature through its Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. We've been working on the budget for several months, starting in April, with a retreat held with our county administrator, the members of the legislature. We turned things over to him at that time, and he's been working all through the summer with our departments and our department heads, and has crafted a recommended budget that we received at the very beginning of September. We started having meetings. We've had six of them, in which we have listened to presentations from all of the department heads and agencies, which we sponsor. They had an opportunity to talk about their base budgets, what they've been doing, and also to make their pitches for extra money for what we call over-target requests. We like to have this forum every year before we begin what we call our voting meetings, and they start tomorrow night. We'll have two or three of them in which we will go through various extra money requests and programs or other things that legislators want to talk about, and we will then make voting decisions, end up with a recommendation to the full legislature, which will then debate it, possibly amend it some more, and send it to public hearing. This will get us into November before we adopt it. So that, in a nutshell, is sort of the process that we're going through. Tonight, we'd like to start by turning this over to our county administrator, Jason Molino, who is going to take about 15 minutes to give you a brief rundown of the budget. Jason?
Thank you, Mike. So this presentation is a smaller, shorter, more condensed presentation from what we gave at the beginning of September when the budget was released. This should stick to about 15 minutes. I'm going to go through this quickly. Obviously, I can come back to any page if there's any question.
Can you folks hear all right?
Okay. It could be a little louder.
Okay, Faye.
That's better, yeah.
All right. It's hard to compete with you, Faye, but I'll do what I can. All right. So we'll go through this. The bottom line, we'll start with the end of the book before the beginning of it. Stable growth in revenues. We've had stable sales tax growth, stable tax base growth. I'll talk a little bit about that. New priority with the capital plan, which is to achieve a goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions in county operations by 2035. This was part of the energy strategy that was adopted in August of this year. Levy is up 2.67%. That is the target that was provided and the direction that was provided by the legislature in May. The rate is actually going down. We'll talk a little bit of why that is. And the solid waste fee is being proposed going up by $2 a household. Total impact on the average homeowner of $190,000 assessed value is about $15. Major budget drivers, revenues, sales tax, tax base, casino revenue. I'll talk a little bit about that as well. Capital program, labor costs, and unfunded mandates drive our expenditures, which doesn't really change much from year to year. Sales tax, the recommended budget provides growth with an eye on the unknown. The 2020 budget balances record growth over the prior 2 years. In general, we are proposing and recommending about just under a 4% growth in 2020 over 2019. 2019 was about a 5.5% growth over 18, which had record years. We're expecting that growth to slow in future years. And if Rick's report last night showed that we were about a 5.6% growth, we'll do a little analysis before tomorrow evening's meeting, just so you know that if we were to have the same September, October, November, December of last year, what that would mean for this year, to see if there's any room for flexibility. It also allows for a course correction. One big unknown is what will happen in November of next year, and will the national election change anything and change market demands. Taxable assessed value, this is the the value of property that is taxed in the county. Again, we had over 4% growth over last year, 17% growth over the past 5 years, and almost 30% in the last 10 years. I mentioned this earlier. This is not typical of most communities in the state of New York. This is, a benefit of some of the growth throughout the county, just not the city, but throughout the county, as we're seeing some steady, what we'll call new lumber in a lot of new areas. It allows for the spread of government costs across a greater base, which is the primary reason why the tax levy may be going up, but the tax rate is going down because it's being spread across a greater base. Casino revenue, 2018 was the first time in the budget. Revenue from DeLago, Tioga Downs and DeLago, ironically not in the county, but the way the legislation is set up, we benefit from it because we are adjacent to those counties. 2018 had a downgrade in their bonding, so we expected some slowdown. That wasn't the case, even though going into 2019, and while we thought that would have an impact, it hasn't. Ownership changes have been announced in 2019, and that it still hasn't seemed to have any impact. There is still growth in the revenue. So up to date, as of July, you had an 8% growth over 2018, and we added another $300,000 to the $1.2 million of this year. So total budget for casino revenue is $1.5. If it's going at the rate it is, it may come in at 2% or $2 million, I'm sorry, for 2019. So we are still well below that, only because it has not really stabilized. It's only had two complete years after this year of something to base on. I would say get another few years under our belt, and then we'll be able to maybe hone in on that a little bit more. Capital plan. The capital plan is it demonstrates a 5-year capital plan, but actually updates it for longer than that. It targets with a specific goal of trying to achieve net zero emissions by 2035. And what we're proposing is investing about $100 million over the next 15 years to achieve those goals. And that includes facilities. It also includes our vehicles, primarily our passenger fleet. This would require us to increase our capital appropriation, which we currently have as our policy, which is a 0.5% of the prior year's levy, to increase it to a 1% over the prior year's levy, and that is built in to this proposed budget. Real brief, some of the investments. It assumes $32 million of investments for different facilities that aren't going to be focused on primarily, but we'll have some improvements to them to try to achieve net zero emissions. It assumes $22 million for a downtown campus, $30 million for public safety building improvements, $7 million to cover airport improvements. If you remember, the airport is a geothermal airport now. $6.5 million for a backup dispatch center, $2 million to electrify our fleet. There's also another $4.5 million for other facility improvements that we would probably wrap into the green facility improvements. That could be things like elevators, so on and so forth, windows, that would also be put in part of those improvements. This graph shows you that this would be the capital levy at the 1% mark. This would be the projected capital expenses based on how we have them projected now. This is your fund balance in your capital fund. And as you can see, it dips down a little bit here, which is why we're proposing to transfer $2.5 million of fund balance from the general fund to the capital fund so that this balance can increase a little bit. So on the years where we're maybe not generating enough to the capital appropriation but taking on more debt, we have the fund balance to recover from it. And as you can see, as these out years go on, these lines become closer. This, of course, will change. I would expect to change based on more planning over the next 12 to 24 years. When we start to drill down on when these series of improvements will happen, that was when we will start to incur more debt. So my suspicion is that this will probably pan out a little bit. Maybe the bump might be out here, so to speak. Nonetheless, this capital fund could use a little bit of cash through this fund balance transfer to make sure it stays above the $1 or $2 million mark. Labor costs are a big part of our costs in general because we're a service provider. White-collar and blue-collar contracts are in place until the end of 2020. That's about 65% of our workforce. We are in active negotiations with the corrections unit, which is our correction officers at the jail, as well as our patrol, which is the deputies for the sheriff's office. Budget assumes settlements within the parameters that are outlined in this contract, these contracts. And a work item for next year will be to try to conclude those contracts, which we'll hopefully be able to do, if not by the end of this year, into next year. labor cost FTEs. So this is a new slide. It does not explain everything, but it gives a little bit of an explanation. So in the budget book, you'll notice there's a correction page out. The net change in FTEs, as total FTEs, from 2019 to 2020 is just under 23 FTEs. This does not mean new positions. This does not mean new bodies, so to speak. What this is, and this does not include positions that might have been added mid-year. So I'll give you an example. Veterans Office was budgeted at the beginning of, as part of the adopted budget in 2019. It did not have a position in the FTE column in 2019, but the position was created from that funding in mid-year 2020. So while the adopted 19 budget has a zero for FTEs, the 2020 has one. Therefore, there is a net increase in position. It doesn't mean that it's new to this year, but it did not come up in the 19 FTEs. That's an example. Of the new of the 22.9 FTEs that are showing a net change, there are 17.7 FTEs that are new, meaning positions that currently do not exist in the modified 2019 budget as of today. A good portion of those are one-time positions or portions of positions that are part of succession planning. That does not mean that they are necessarily supported by the tax levy. It means they could be supported by a variety of different funding sources. One could be OTRs, which is funded through reserves. They could be funded through other municipal contributions. They could be funded through grants. For example, the data collector position for the assigned counsel's office. And they could be funded through the levy. Or they could be funded in the existing target budget of a department. So, for example, if a department had a decrease in other expenses and added this position but was still within their target, that could also be part of this. These are current positions that do not exist. Of those 17.78, 3.98 positions of new positions are funded by the tax levy increase, I should say.
Will you say that again, slowly? Fast.
About four of the new FTE positions, 3.98, are funded by the tax levy increase. So that means the district attorney, I'll go through them, has one paralegal aide that is a full position. The confidential investigator is 0.68 of a position. The sheriff has one deputy that's funded by the levy. Workforce Development Board has a half a position for the deputy director. And Board of Elections has 0.8 of a clerk that is funded by this tax levy increase. Healthcare premiums are up about 6%, remain flat. Pension remains flat. It's actually just a tad below, but it's not worth changing at this stage of the game. It's like a hundredth of a tenth, 200 points. Overall fringe is up about 2%, which is about $500,000 over last year. Mandates. So for the fifth consecutive year, our mandates have been manageable, under a percent increase, which is good. We've had some changes, criminal justice reforms. We had a good lengthy discussion at this, the public safety meeting, as well as the last budget meeting. And then last night, you did approve the advanced hiring of these two positions, the paralegal aid and the confidential investigator, to allow the district attorney's office to prepare for the changes in discovery primarily. Early voting changes, more techs. Early voting requires more hours, more days, therefore more techs need to be available to help man the voting stations and be available. Sponsored agency partners, we have sponsored and partner agencies. We have 2% increase in baseline budgets. There's about 372,000 and mostly in one-time OTRs to support the agencies. And this year we have a 5% increase in TC3's contribution. If you remember, over the past, I think, 3 years, we've had zero increase because Cortland County has refused to increase the contribution, which we have to do equally. They have agreed this year our share is about $148,000. Contingency stays with about a $900,000 contingent budget. That seems to be about, on average, what you're using out of contingency on an annual basis. And we discontinued the separate $300,000 OTR because we have not had jail board outs. So this would have been the fourth year. I'm sorry, this year, the 2019, is the third year. We do not feel it's necessary to continue it. And in fact, ironically, this year you've had board ins as opposed to board outs. So I would say at this stage of the game, it does not appear that that's going to be something we're going to need. The airport, we've all familiar with the airport. Some good changes going on at the airport. Right now, the project is roughly around $37 million. About $10 million will be locally bonded. $3 million will be covered by passenger facility charges, which are charges that passengers pay as they go through the airport. $7 million has been included in the capital plan, spread out over about a 20 to a 25-year period. We are going to be applying to the state legislature with the help of our local assemblywoman and senator to get the extension from a 10-year to a 25-year bond for this amount of money. Operations remain flexible. We have the customs facility still to go online, airline changes, new flights. So as we take on more flights, different flights, larger airplanes, PFCs will go up, which means we'll be able to commit more PFC revenue toward that $7 million. Recycling has had a tough year. It's had a tough few years, and that's not because of anything on our end, but just because the industry has changed. The recycling and solid waste industry has been flipped upside down. Commodities are nowhere where they were before. For example, in prior years, we would generate roughly $900,000 or $1,900,000 worth of recycling revenue. We are down to under $200,000 now. That's primarily the industry. So before we would pay haulers to bring recycling material to us, we no longer need to do that because there's no revenue to be generated. So part of that has to do with an increase of $2 per household for their solid waste fee. It also recommends additional fees for commercial haulers. This is primarily commercial haulers that bring waste or bring recyclables into the facility over a commercial ave. Some of it will be individual or resident-based. So, for example, there may be a small charge for green waste and some other tech pieces that have to be brought on. Due to increases in expenses and decreases in revenue, it's a primary reason. Also, in 2020, we have the new request for proposal for a new 10-year agreement to operate the commercial ave facility. This will probably trigger some changes. It may trigger an increase in cost. It may trigger a discussion about providing services in a different way. It may also trigger an increase in the solid waste fee if those services want to be continued. We don't know, but I suspect the mid-year we'll have some good discussion about what the results of that RFP were and what are the decisions moving forward. This year is expected to finish with a loss of about $400,000. Next year, we're budgeting with the expectation of a loss of about $300,000. That includes some cuts in expenses, and it includes increasing the solid waste fee in commercial haulers. We have a good, healthy fund balance, which allows us to have this loss this year and accept the loss next year. But beyond 2020, I would not recommend we continue to have a loss because that will not continue very much longer until we're subsidizing through the general fund. As I mentioned, the 2020 RFP is a key piece to this. OTRs, there were about $3.1 million worth of OTRs in the recommended budget. There's 2.7, 1.8 of one-time, and 900,000 of target. I won't go through all of these, but the capital is a big piece of it. Quite a few positions, as I mentioned earlier. Facilities has equipment replacements, and there's a continuation, for example, of the housing grant fund that we put out of the planning office and a series of different workforce investments. There is a decent amount of positions that are partial positions for succession planning. And here are some increases to local agencies for some of their requests as well. We've been through a lot of that through the past six meetings. Tax cap was about a 4.7% increase over the current levy. We are at 2.76%, so we're drastically under it. I will make one note. The primary reason we have a large tax cap this year is because we had a large rollover from last year, which I would say and put a plug in that the less that we increase the levy this year, the more of a rollover will happen for next year and the year after. For when times slow down or when the economy slows down or for whatever reason we come into certain economic challenges, having a large rollover allows us greater capacity so that a tax cap override does not have to happen. There is also another service now or two or state aid that is now tied into staying under the tax cap. For example, raise the age reimbursement was tied into if you stay under the tax cap and don't override, you'll get the reimbursement. So there's other reasons and motivations to try to stay under the tax cap. Tax-based growth is a big contributor to that increase as well. More lumber, new, it's not just an increase in market sales of buildings, existing buildings. It's a contribution of new construction. And the sales tax credits, the Dryden factor from last year is not the case this year, where they had the sales tax credits that they wanted, which drastically increased the tax cap last year. 2.76 meets the financial goals that the legislature set in May. It's under the tax cap. It supports operations as well as a 2% for each agency, and it supports the new capital program, and it captures a good chunk of sales tax growth. Tax rate goes down. Remember, the primary reason it's going down, even though the levy is going up, is because you have a large growth in taxable assessed value. It was down about 10 cents from 641 to 631. Average bill in 2020 is about $1,200. The reason why this is an increase over 19 is because your median house value increased from 185 to 190. So put in another way, if your property or your house, for example, did not increase in its assessed value, your county taxes would go down this year. If your house went up in taxable assessed value, it would go up depending on how much it went up. I throw in the $2 solid waste fee. It's roughly about $15 on the median home. And I think we're in just about 15 minutes.
Wow.
Thank you. So sort of like the theme song to the Big Bang Theory. We went through quite a bit in a very short time. We wanted you to have that, at least exposure to that, something we've talked about for a long time. I'd like to start by saying we're really pleased to see so many people here tonight. We've had these budget forums with only a handful of people, and in tougher years we've had a lot of people, but it's great to see everybody out tonight. We're going to give folks a chance to speak. We're going to ask you to keep your comments to about 3 minutes. We aren't running the clock tonight, but we're asking you to be respectful of other people. And if other people come in, we'll ask them to sign up if they'd like to speak as well. We have a group of people that would like to talk about one matter, and that's 4-H urban outreach. So I'm going to take them first. The first person we're going to have is Sarah Barden. If you'd please step to the microphone, one of the microphones back there, and we'd be pleased to hear from you.
Good evening. Thank you for allowing me this time. My name is Sarah Barden, and I'm the chair of the 4-H Youth Development Program Committee, and I'm a member of the Board of Directors at Cornell Cooperative Extension in Tompkins County. I'm here with several volunteers and participants from the 4-H Urban Outreach Program. I'm probably the least important person to speak, but I'm going to set the stage for you guys. First, I'd like to thank you all for your support of 4-H Youth Development last year. We came with an over-target request for funding to upgrade the 4-H Acres facility, and we really appreciate your support of that request. We not only were able to complete the entirety of the plan of work as we had proposed, but we came in $25,000 under budget and are using the additional funds to do some risk management upgrades. So thank you again for your support, and for those of you who were able to attend the tours that we had of the 4-H Acres facility, we appreciate the time that you took, and we were really glad to have you there during the county fair when our youth were in action. Tonight, we're asking for your continued support, but this time for the 4-H Urban Outreach Program. At Cooperative Extension, 4-H Youth Development comprises four programs. There's 4-H Clubs, Rural Youth Services, Primitive Pursuits, and 4-H Urban Outreach. And all of these clubs have differences in their participants, in their structure, and in their budget. The Urban Outreach Program in particular provides positive youth development and leadership opportunities for some of the most vulnerable youth in Tompkins County, particularly children of low socioeconomic status and many children of color. Currently, programming occurs at the West Village and Northside neighborhoods, and the continued existence of this program is due extensively to the dedication of Ramona Cornell, who's the sole full-time staff person, and then Tammy Snyder, who is a part-time staff person. The Urban Outreach Program began 40 years ago at West Village and was funded in part from money provided by the owners of the West Village neighborhood. After the sale of those properties, the funding was lost. However, the needs of the youth in that neighborhood did not change just because the funding was lost. So the 4-H Youth Development Program has worked to become a consistent support even as those funding sources have changed. While other 4-H youth development programs may charge for programming or rely on a large network of volunteers and parents, in this case, the Urban Outreach Program always strives to make sure that their programming is free for their participants, and they rely on a much smaller group of many youth and teens and young adults who have gone through the program and now volunteer and support it. So their needs are quite different from some of the other programs. Despite the loss of the West Village funding, Ramona and Tammy continued to execute the programming in order to become that stay that consistent support system for the participants, and that led to a deficit in the program's budget. So we're asking for $18,000 of bridge funding to carry the program into 2020, ensuring that the support system can remain available for those youth. In the meantime, CCE recognizes the need to find consistent funding streams for it, and so we're continuing our efforts to ensure that we're able to support the program beyond this bridge funding. Tonight, following me, you'll hear from other volunteers and participants of the program who will give you a better impression of the impact of urban outreach in Tompkins County. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope I don't mess this name up, but it's Joanne Grutadorario.
Pretty close, sir. Grutadorario.
Thank you.
Hi. I'm a volunteer with the 4-H program area, and I just wanted to speak within two capacities, as a volunteer and as a member of the 4-H program committee. I volunteered at the urban program at West Village 4 or 5 years and have had different experiences here that I'd like to share with you. As a subject matter person, of course, we did lots of plant science programs with the kids, and when I wasn't directly teaching, I had a chance to make observations, and I was extremely impressed with those kids. They would come bouncing off the bus, and they knew the structure that was in place for them. I saw the kids support each other and almost mentor each other at times. No homework meant reading, so if the kids already had done their homework, they had to read. But there were kids that would stop and actually help the younger kids with their reading. So I felt that I saw cooperation, responsibility, and caring. And as I said, I was there like six weeks in a row to make these impressions. They learned lots about nutrition, and I was just stunned at the kinds of snacks these kids would have. And there was one day I was there, and I saw avocado and figs and hummus and all kinds of funny. I was looking for a cookie. And so I went over to one little one, and I said, "What do we have here?" And they explained all of the nutritional value and then walked me to a poster that showed what they had learned about nutrition. So to me, it's beyond a safe, secure place. This after-school program really built confidence and cooperation, and I saw, you know, responsibility coming together with this. We did one special program where we worked with the city forester. We had some holes dug so we could plant trees. So that was done. The kids helped plant the trees, amend the soil, mulch it. They proudly put a tag on that, and they were very proud of their accomplishment there. And we would go back, and there was no vandalism. There was a lot of pride wrapped around this actual project that was outside but part of the after-school program. So we stepped back and we said to the kids, "Well, what do you think about this?" And they said, "Well, I think I see some things that we can pick up and recycle, and I think maybe we could just tidy up the sidewalk a little bit." So it made me happy to see that they learned at a workshop. It extended beyond what they were doing indoors, and they were looking at their community and how to make it better. So for me as a volunteer, this is like what we live for, to see kids take their knowledge and feel like they can make a difference. So the other quote that I want to mention was, these kids do get to go on field trips, and to me that extends what their world vision is. And one of the kids was asked on a field trip, "How do you feel about this?" And the kid said, "I feel like I'm free." And so to me, it, you know, what we do in the after-school program is one thing, but also exposing them to these different experiences is also very critical. Also on the 4-H program committee, and we've made a priority to raise funding this year. We're thankful for all of the donations we get from the private citizens and our funding partners, and we have people that are awesome at getting grants, but we know we need to come up with a more sustainable model. So we do have a subcommittee that will be working on this, and we actually will be meeting with a very successful development professional who will guide our subcommittee in putting together a plan to really pull in some more money to support this program.
Could you sum up, please?
Oh, thanks.
Let's go to Henry Hanstein next.
Good evening. My name is Henry Hanstein, and I'm here tonight on behalf of the 4-H Urban Outreach Program, which is based from the Cornell Cooperative Extension and conducted by Ramona Cornell. Her program serves primarily child refugees who fled with their families from Myanmar to camps in Thailand in order to escape religious and ethnic persecution. These lucky few were then sponsored, which enabled them to come to Ithaca. The 4-H Urban Outreach Program greatly helps these children manage the language and cultural transition that comes with leaving your homeland and moving halfway around the globe. Ramona told me of one incident where a uniformed police officer came to the program for an unrelated traffic accident, and she noticed some of the children seemed visibly upset. And after the policeman left, one of the kids, the older kids, asked her how much she had to pay him to go away and leave them alone. So, of course, Ramona explained to the group that things are different here and the policemen are actually there to help and do not need to be feared. For over a decade, I've donated money, food, supplies, and served as a volunteer with various activities. I drive a van to take the children to events and activities such as weekly trips to the free science workshop, where they gain useful knowledge on a wide variety of subjects and get hands-on experience taking things apart, using tools, and building things. We've also taken them to Corning Glass, the Curtis Museum, apple picking, bowling, the rink in Lansing, several camping trips to the Arnett Forest, and more. Unfortunately, this wonderful program exists on a shoestring budget, and it's funded by small private donations, in-kind contributions, grants, and fundraising. We've even taken the children to the Cornell campus to raise money by selling virtual ducks to passersby for the annual Duck Race fundraiser. It's a pleasure to engage with these children and watch them learn and grow in a friendly, fun, and educational environment with their peers. They're really good kids who greatly benefit from the extra help this program provides. The 4-H Urban Outreach Program is apparently in desperate need of $18,000 in bridge money to keep it going, which is why I'm here tonight. I truly believe that this is a great investment that benefits not only the children in the program and their families, but also our community, because it helps create productive, responsible, respectful, and educated youth who quickly become adults. I feel really good about donating my time and money to this program, and I'm sure the members of this board would feel the same way if they were familiar with the program, its participants, and the positive results and benefits it produces. My hope is that you can move some numbers around and find $18,000 for the 4-H Urban Outreach Program. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. Another name, I hope I don't mess up too bad, Eartha Ewely. Eartha, please. And after her will be Deborah Dietrich.
Sorry?
I just announced the person who speaks after you.
Okay, thank you.
Please go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. Hi, my name is Eartha Ewely, and I'm currently attending Wells College right now. I used to be in the 4-H Urban Outreach, the 4-H After School Program, and now I'm working with them and I volunteer for them because they're in my heart. But I started the program when I was in second grade. So when I first came to Ithaca, my friends were in it, so I was in it right away. And I've been in it since, and I graduated high school 2 years ago, and I was still in it. I was still helping out. And this program means so much to me because as a young child, I was really struggling because I didn't know the language, and I was just wild everywhere. And this program helped me really get me in charge, get me to focus more on education. I was having a really hard time reading, and this since we have volunteers, like the Cornell students, I was able to have somebody sit with me and read with me, and because of that program, my English is so much better now, so much. And it's really, like, good for me. I also want to talk about, like, field trips and stuff like that. Since my family, both my parents work very, very hard, like, every single day, me and my brother weren't able to go to places that we wanted to go. Like, we couldn't go to museums. We couldn't go to, like, apple picking, all of that, because they were either expensive, far away, or we just couldn't do it because of timing. So being in the program, I was able to go to field trips that I wouldn't even get to go. I wouldn't even get to go apple picking because my parents would just be like, you can just go buy it at the store. So I wouldn't even have the experience of going and picking apples or going to see the museum, the glass museum, because there will be just like, it's just glass. What's so important? You know, like, and the reason for that is because it's not because they didn't want to go. It's because we can't afford to go. So they make up excuses where we just can't go. So being in the program, I was able to explore many of the things I like now through the program, if that's understanding. Yeah. Like, I'm a science major right now, and I fell in love with science because of, like, this little science experiment that Ramona Cornell has taught me when I was younger. And she made me not just explore my comfort zone, but she took me out of the community so that I can be, like, out there, so that when I'm out of the world, I know exactly what I'm doing. I don't know what time I have left. Yeah, just, I think I'm good. I don't know.
Thank you for talking to us tonight. Deborah Dietrich, then Melissa Cady.
Good evening. It may surprise you, I'm not here to talk about OAR tonight. that's what you're used to hearing me talk about, but I'm here to ask you to consider supporting OTR 39, which is the Continuum of Care's efforts to end homelessness. I'm here because in 2017, OAR came to you all about a house for 5 formerly incarcerated males. Endeavor House, you helped us purchase that house. We've reimbursed you for that amount. But part of the financing came from the COC's $50,000 appropriation. We got $18,000, which really allowed us to put in, I'll make it dramatic, the toilets. We could have had the whole house done and no toilets, but that $18,000 really pieced it together, and I think it's been spent for a lot of important projects, and I thank you for your previous funding and ask you to consider funding that again. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Melissa Cady, then Faye Gugakis.
Hi, I'm here to talk about the College Initiative Program. I'm a student I'm a little nervous. Okay, anyways. So, long story short, I'm a student with the College Initiative Program, and they're looking for funding from you guys. And I'm just here to tell you that 10 months ago, I was a drug addict who needed a lot of help. I have 10 months sober. In January, I'm going to go to TC3 and become a college student, and I wouldn't have done it without the people from the College Initiative Program. And I just wanted to be there for people when I'm done, you know. So, thank you.
Thank you for coming, and thanks for your effort. Faye Gugakis, yeah. And then
I wish I could
Raphael
be that
Lepante.
Short. But I'm not going to. I can, but I'm not going to. Good evening, everyone. Faye Gugakis, City of Ithaca. I will use my 3 minutes. I have to confess I haven't looked at the budget or looked at numbers. I'm just here to suggest some things, if they're able to be suggested. As you know, I've been dealing with the Lyme bike issue for a year. I don't know who's listening. I just came from City Hall. I've been coming here for a year now. The day they came to Ithaca, I made so many phone calls. As you know, you were more receptive than the city, and I appreciate that. I don't know if anybody watched Sunday morning CBS News. They were highlighting the e-scooters and the problems communities, maybe not all, are having with them. Recently, we've had a couple of Lyme bikes catch on fire. I know Henry said it was the brakes the other day. Okay. Well, I have not seen a report from anybody saying that it was the brakes. I only heard that they caught on fire. If you go online, you will see that this is a major problem. I've already talked about this. It's a problem. They catch on fire. The e-scooters catch on fire. You know, there's no responsibility with the company here in Ithaca. All of a sudden, it's like, oh, somebody did something to them. Now, that could be the case. But what I'm trying to get at is this company, like other companies like Lyft and other, they come into communities unannounced because that's the way they do things. They come in unannounced. They deal predominantly with the mayors of the communities, which they did with our mayor, okay, and they just show up on our streets. When we teach kids responsibility, this is not a company that shows responsibility. I mean, they're left in the middle of a sidewalk. When we talk about differently abled people, how is someone blind going to, what are they going to do with if they come up to a bike or somebody in a wheelchair? Because they are left in the middle of a sidewalk. Maybe not all of them, but you don't need all of them to be in the middle of a sidewalk so it encumbers somebody. I don't understand how here in Ithaca we cannot see this problem. I live with this every day. It bothers me. When we talk about climate change, I've been riding my bike since 1982. I don't tell people that they should do that. I don't tell people to get out of their cars. You know, but if you're going to drive, if you're going to talk about sustainability, then please listen to a cyclist. Now, I might be the only cyclist coming before you. I don't know what's happening with the other cyclists. But I've been cycling since 1982, and this issue has driven me mad. Okay, not mad enough where I did something to the Lyme bikes. I have not. I wish I could. I'll go on record. I wish I could throw them away, you know, but I can't. But you know, I beg this community to realize what a problem it is. So why I came here tonight is I was thinking, it's just a suggestion. It's not a nice suggestion, and I'm not basically a cruel person or a mean person. But I think if we're not going to do a resolution, we need to get to the budget. We need to get to the finances. Because I called the Park Foundation, which gives money to Bike Walk Tompkins. Bike Walk Tompkins helped the mayor bring the Lyme bikes. They were in cahoots, okay? They don't care about the problem, okay? If they are funded by you, you tell them if you want this money, and I'm not trying to sound like Donald Trump either. If you want this money, then you have to deal with this problem. I mean, I don't know how else to do it. I just don't know how else to do it. I mean, you know, we talk about alternative transportation and, you know, being mindful to the planet. Nobody's disputing that. It's like you have the cell phone technology. I mean, think about how crazy that is. People going around talking, they're walking right in front of you, they're disrespecting somebody reading a book or eating at a restaurant. These are all behaviors that are in our modern way of life, are disrespectful. They're antisocial. Faking. They're creating a world that is, you know, there's I'm running out of time, but I want to say one more thing to close, which I know I wasn't going to have time to get into. But I would like us to also put money into air monitoring because of development. All this development is way too much, too fast for our community. We have to deal with light pollution. We have to deal with the wireless technology, which I'm sure is affecting us, and the 5G that's coming, and to decide whether as a community we want that or not, distracted driving, whether we want uncontrolled cell phone use on buses. When we talk about alternative transportation, I ride a bus. I'm not happy when I'm in a bus with 20 people on their cell phones yakking for 20 minutes. I mean, these are things that when you use public transportation, it affects you. Then getting in a car and going out in the country and parking in your parking spot. Am I speaking English or not?
You've had 5 minutes now.
I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, we do.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Faye.
And I was just alerted to the fact, Faye, that this week you will be celebrating a birthday. We want to say happy birthday to you.
Oh, happy birthday, Faye.
Happy birthday, Faye.
It was yesterday, but, you know, thank you.
Well, belated greetings. We have Rob.
More receptive than the city. I thank you very much.
Next up is Rafael Aponte.
Have a good night.
Welcome.
Good evening, folks. I'm going to set my stopwatch. My name is Rafael Aponte, owner-operator of Rocky Acres Community Farm in Dryden. I'm also on the board of the Youth Farm Project located in Danby, which works on creating links between agriculture, youth, and social justice. I'm also on the National Young Farmers Coalition, and a working member of the Central New York chapter. I'm most recently on the board of the Northeast Farmers of Color. But today, I'm here to speak to you on behalf of the Food Policy Council, the Tompkins County Food Policy Council. We are asking for a comprehensive food plan to be developed for Tompkins County. It's an idea whose time has come. I applaud CCE for the vision, for being able to put a budget line into the over-target request for the assessment of the comprehensive food plan that should take place in this county. Like I said, I'm a farmer, and food is something that touches every aspect of life on the multiple boards and associations that I'm with. And coming here to the last budget meeting, hearing every single department, every single person who's asking for a request in budget have some kind of relationship to food. And what we need to do is look at the different barriers that folks are facing to accessing that food in the first place. And then also, that's part of our strength as a county, right? From hearing the county airport say that people are coming to this county just for the food, right? To hearing DSS say that the families are facing serious barriers to accessing food in their communities. According to the last community health assessment that was done for the county for 2017, some alarming numbers that came out of that, for me as a food producer, 100% of single mothers in the town of Ithaca as well as the town of Dryden are below the poverty line. And these are the lifeblood for our youth in the community. So it's not just based here. It's not an urban problem. It's not a rural problem. This is a problem that needs to be addressed countywide. And that's done by us taking a comprehensive look at what that looks like, whether we're talking about economy and tourism, the people who are coming here to spend their dollars, the students that come to visit my farm over we're probably going to hit 500 students this year who come from half of which come from outside the county to visit our local colleges, to have a relationship to land and agriculture, education, the environment. One of the quickest ways that we can reduce our carbon footprint is by reducing the amount of miles that food has to travel. And this would be an enormous boon for our local farmers. We have about 10% local food procurement here in Tompkins County. To have an assessment to how we can get that number up and a commitment to increase that by at least 5%, 10%, right? The effects on energy, the effects on water. to look at the relationships between our community gardens that serve as a neck sink for water, for purification, but are still faced with the bill that comes from the city and the county to have to pay for water and sewage. All these numerous effects. So me as a farmer and the way that I address that, through food distributions, there's so many people here in this community who are on the margins, on the fringes, and who don't get to access food security. We do our food distributions directly at one of the most underserved populations, and that's the elders in our community. We do food distributions at McGraw Houses and Titus Towers in partnership with the Youth Farm Project. And through that program, we're able to provide fresh, healthy food to them without them having to physically get up and get to the farmer's market. So we need to look at these gaps. I encourage folks, this is a modest amount in the budget, $20,000 for 2 years, to look at the way that food impacts every single sector that operates here in the county, and then hopefully come up with a comprehensive plan to address those things.
So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I have Holly Payne next, then Monica Roth.
Holly had to leave. Sorry, she had to go pick up her son, so I'll just go next.
Well, Monica's next then.
Okay. I, again, am here to speak on behalf of the cooperative extension request for $20,000 to develop a food system plan. And I think Rafa said it very well, but I think everyone agrees that citizens have the right to a safe, healthy food supply, regardless of income and where they live. And we hope that a food plan will begin to look at all the assets we have. We know we have, we're lucky to have what we do have in this community, and lots of resources, but we also know there are gaps, and these gaps are broadening all the time. And there are also new challenges, obviously, with climate change and how that's going to potentially impact food supply. We also have trade and labor uncertainties. We know that. And in addition, there are the ongoing concerns about just access and diet and health and safety risks in our food supply. So Cooperative Extension, in cooperation with the Food Policy Council, is prepared to take on the process of developing a food plan. Our process will include gathering data, doing outreach, holding focus groups, preparing summaries, synthesizing the information we gather, and then coming up with draft recommendations for consideration by community members, by agencies that deal with food system issues, and then hopefully we'll get to a point where we have a plan that we can endorse. We have experience at Cooperative Extension developing plans. I think you know we developed the County Ag and Farmland Protection Plan. We've developed town ag plans. And we have lots of data that we've already gathered about our food system. So we have, you know, we can hit the ground running with this project and just look for the updated information. We also have a lot of experience in community engaged processes. You might know about, last week, the Groton folks talked about what's going on at their library in Groton that's supporting the community and providing food. Extension was involved in that and developing, we held community cafes, so a lot of the initiatives that have come out of that community cafe process is what you see happening in Groton now to address some of the food system needs that were uncovered in that community cafe process. So we're sort of patterning our plan after the Douglas County Food System Plan. I've shared this with several people. This is in Kansas, Lawrence, Kansas, which is where the University of Kansas is. It's kind of similar demographically to our county, so we think there's a lot of relevance in terms of the way they've kind of formatted this plan. And they've also indicated already that as a result of their plan, they've had more collaboration among local agencies. They've been able to access grants that they weren't able to access because now they have the data that they needed to write grants. And it's also helped to continue to inform collaborations with the University of Kansas, but also informed the work of their Food Policy Council. So we thank you for considering this proposal and the opportunity, giving us the opportunity to work on a food system plan. It's something we look forward to in the next 2 years and coming out with a product that I think you as a county will value and will be happy to have accomplished it as a Food Policy Council. So thank you.
Thank you, Monica. I have Neoma Mullins, and then I have Heather Campbell. Either one.
It's been a long day today. Hi, I'm Neoma Mullins, Executive Director of the Learning Web. Those of you who don't know about the Learning Web, we are a positive youth development organization that started in 1972, so one of the first organizations to support youth in the county, like many of the organizations spoke earlier today. I'm here to ask for support for continuation of the COC funding, the continuum of care, working to end homelessness in the county. I won't get into a long sort of list of how we received the money this year, and of course, you know, direct services are important, but I wanted to make sure that I highlight some of the things that the impact of the money used that some of you may not realize. So we received $49,000, almost $50,000 this year, and that funding actually went into three areas: one for a full-time position, a housing program associate position, to work with homeless youth, which there are nearly between roughly 400 and 500 counted each year with unstable housing. We also used some of the funding to meet compliance regulation standards from New York State Office of Family and Children Services, and those regulations quite stringent on our transitional living housing program that we have, and so that additional funding from the county helped us to meet those compliance regulations. We also used about a third of the money to collaborate with Cornell University with a study that actually this morning, which is why I was saying it was a long day, we actually presented, thank you, Henry, for coming out to that, to the Housing Task Force group. And this morning we did have seven youth participants there who all spoke about the impact of our programs in their lives, so that's why they're not here tonight. So those statistics are used by all the members of the COC and many agencies in the county to support the need for homeless youth services. And so that those statistics, and this study, if those of you who don't know, has actually been going on. This is the fifth administration. So for 20 years, we've been working with Cornell University partners in what's called participatory research, where youth are actually trained to become researchers in their community. Many of these youth now, one of them serves on our board currently, and she's employed by the city. She was previously in our program and worked on that project when she was homeless. So, you know, that's just one example. So in addition to what I'm calling this increased capacity, the position that we were able to fund allowed other staff members with more experience in the community, and I'm speaking of people that have worked in homeless youth services for 20 years, 16 years, and 10 years. This new person who was hired, it allowed them to then go out and collaborate with other agencies who are here today, including TC Action, a funded partner in the county, the Advocacy Center, and also the treatment courts. So those individuals could then go out and do this other work because we were able to bring in another position. And also the position directly supported the Independent Living Survey Administration with the youth. I really believe that this funding, this one-time funding, allowed us to leverage additional funding into the county. We just found out this week that the Learning Web was a recipient of federal grant to continue our TILT program, and that's a $250,000 award for 3 years. So we're very excited about that. But I have to tell you that grant application was very intense, quite competitive. We are one of 18 agencies in the country to receive that funding. So without that position, honestly, I don't have a half-time FTE admin. So that position, a young woman whose partner is a PhD student at Cornell, she's new to Ithaca, she came into our agency, hit the ground running, supported me in a way that allowed us to be successful in that grant. I also would say that I think this is the third year of the funding, so just from sort of an evaluation perspective, that is my area of interest in educational policy, that I would say please consider continuing the funding to allow us time to evaluate how one or other agencies can use the money that to continue leveraging funds into the community, rather than, although I do think, you know, one-time projects like the toilets at Unity House are amazing and we need that as well, we also need to keep funding going so that we can then evaluate how we're doing over time rather than just sort of these drops. And that's just my
view. Can you sum up for us, please?
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Heather Campbell, then Kathy Slaughter.
I apologize for the inevitable coughing. My family has the traditional beginning of the school year virus right now. I'm Heather Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Advocacy Center. We're a funded agency and also appreciate your support, but I am also here to talk about the COC funding. And I am passionate enough about it that I am here tonight with this cough instead of home, because it really, we were funded in 2017, the first year, for a pilot project. It was really provided for us proof of concept that we could create an emergency flexible housing fund for survivors of domestic violence and prevent homelessness. And there's a growing body, even since 2017, growing body of research that shows that flexible direct support to survivors of domestic violence who are facing homelessness prevents homelessness. And in fact, it's one of the most effective strategies. Small amounts of one-time money provided when survivors need it most. So we asked for $5,000 for this pilot. And we, during that year, prevented 21 people from being homeless that year with $5,000. So that was 7 adults and 14 children. The average award was $632. The smallest award was $60. That was someone who was going to get evicted over $60 that she could not come up with. It might as well have been $600. The largest award was just over $1,300. And what we saw is this actually had enough of an impact in our county that we diverted enough families from our shelter during that summer that our shelter was actually empty for 5 weeks. It actually impacted our shelter census. And, you know, back rent, security deposits, partial security deposits, last month rent, it would have, with just under $5,000, we prevented homelessness. If we had sheltered those 21 people for the average length of stay at our shelter, which that year was 42 days, which is not how long most of these families had multiple barriers. They would have likely stayed longer than 42 days. In fact, one of the families was in our shelter and was stuck without this funding. It would have cost the county, DSS, $63,000 in shelter fees just for the average cost. So this program was really cost effective, but it was also really humane, because as nice as we make our shelters are not good for people. Homes are good for people. And, you know, housing, you all must spend a lot of time talking about housing. I know you do. I spend a lot of time talking about housing. It is like the elephant in all of our meetings. And this funding has allowed programs like mine to take risks and try things and do innovative things. We've now been able to leverage some continued funding from foundations, from Cornell, from other places, because we have data showing that this was impactful and cost effective. So I really encourage you to consider continuing this funding, and because we're not going to build our way out of this problem, at least not quickly, and we need to be looking at these kinds of innovative solutions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kathy Slaughter, then Don Barber.
So I'm here to just kind of wrap up from my people, and I just wanted to add a, take a, just a minute of your time to add a little more to my presentation the other night. It was late. We were tired. I had to talk about 22 different agencies. So tonight I just want to take a minute to talk a little bit about the programs that are dedicated to homelessness. You know, I realize that when you hear the word homeless all the time in housing, it can seem like a really confusing array of programs. Unfortunately, I like to say it isn't, but that's what it's going to take to tackle homelessness. Last night, there were 94 people who were housed in the shelter, and we aren't even in the cold weather yet. So I just kind of want to emphasize what you heard from the people I came asked to come here tonight and talk, that there's not one position or one little fund that's going to solve this problem. It is going to be a whole suite of programs that are dedicated to this. You are going to need some funding to help people not be evicted. You're going to need some staff time to help people stay in housing once they're there. And you're going to need programs that'll work with landlords. We are losing landlords at an alarming rate every day. Every time there's more regulations, more housing goes off the market, somebody to support people to stay in the housing we have. The services that we fund through these pots of money are services that the people who work every day with this population say are needed to solve this problem. So with everybody else, I would request that you continue the funding for the COC. It's funded a lot of great programs. It's given people that year so that they can find other funding to continue the programs, and it's been a real help, and our problem is not going away anytime soon. So, and I agree with Heather, we are not going to build our way out of this. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Martin?
Do you have a question or something?
No, I just want to say something before Kathy leaves. A lot of people have left. So, what, you had other speakers?
We have two more speakers. Yeah.
Okay. Don't go, Kathy.
Don Barber, then Dan Hoffman.
Good evening. I spoke with you last week on behalf of the Food Policy Council to introduce the over-target request for funding the Tompkins County Food System Plan. And I returned to be a little bit more direct and to again urge your support. When our food travels 1,500 miles to our table, when whole food that is shipped great distances is picked long before it's ripe and has not created as much of its nutrition that's present in ripe fruit, think of out-of-season strawberries and tomatoes, when only 10% of our $250 million food economy is produced locally, our food system is not secure. Recent events of international instability of fossil fuel and tariff changes show us that events outside our country will affect our food security. We don't understand how our food system works, and we're all vulnerable. Worldwide, when food processing and production network is consolidated by five behemoths, multinational corporations that squeeze growers to make choices that reduce costs, then the food is processed in a way that removes most of the minerals and enzymes critical to our health and push out a mash loaded with carbohydrates, sugar, salt, and a little color and flavor added in. Our food system is not secure. In fact, public health issues of diabetes and obesity are directly related. When 30% of our families face food insecurity daily, this insecurity is recognized and partially, but by no means completely addressed by food pantries, emergency networks, food rescue, and the lines are getting longer. Our food system is not secure. Tompkins County's food system is large and vulnerable, and it is our responsibility to understand the food system and make appropriate decisions to provide security. The food system plan would be a comprehensive planning process consistent with others that the county has used for housing, energy, water, and so on. Monica has detailed the process that we would use, but the long-term outcomes that we're envisioning are increased food security and healthy food for all, improved community diet and health, better support for food pantries and other food support agencies, an expansion in the number of viable farms and local food processing and local food distribution businesses, and benefits for our environment and reduced carbon footprint. When asked, please vote to fund the food system plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Dan Hoffman.
Good evening. My name is Dan Hoffman. I live in the city of Ithaca. Lived in Tompkins County for over 50 years, and I've been active most of that time on issues involving the environment, food, and social justice. Right now, I am a member of the Food Policy Council, which is co-sponsoring the proposal to create a food system plan. I'm also on the board for Project Growing Hope, which runs the Ithaca Community Gardens. I've been very involved with Green Star Co-op's governance for 48 years, and I'm a member of the co-op's tax-exempt affiliate called Green Star Community Projects, which focuses on food system issues. And all of this has given me a perspective and some experience with the food system that serves our county. And although, as has been noted, we are blessed with a number of impressive grassroots and private and even governmental efforts in the food area, what we're lacking is a comprehensive approach with support and guidance from our local government. The food system, in my opinion, is not serving us as well as it could be, and that's a problem that is best looked at from a countywide perspective. We are both an agricultural and an urban county, and we need both components to come up with a successful plan. There are challenges now, and there are many more coming in the near future. I'm sure you're aware of that. Having a good plan is step number one. Luckily, many other counties and cities have shown the way. They have developed comprehensive food system plans, and they are now implementing them. We've looked at those models, and we think that we can learn a lot, make our task a lot easier, some of the groundwork that they've done. In my opinion, cooperative extension is the perfect supervisor for this kind of effort, given their long experience with agriculture and food issues. And I think they're offering the county and taxpayers a bargain. For $20,000 a year for 2 years, I believe you will have a very useful, comprehensive plan that will show us what can be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Is there anyone here who would like to speak to us who hasn't had an opportunity? Well, we've been fortunate to hear from 14 different speakers tonight. Sorry, one had to leave early. And we had other people here to listen. We appreciate that. Now, Martha Robertson has a question for one of the audience.
Well, I just wanted to say, I think, Kathy, that I think you hope this is your last county budget, right?
Yeah, I believe
okay. That. Well, I mean, folks come and go, but we just... It's impossible to say how much you've meant to the county and to the constituents, the people who live in the county. And
that's very sweet of you. Thank you.
I just really want to thank you from your position at the DSS for many years, and I'm not sure what before that, but especially really grabbing hold of the Human Services Coalition and making it grow to be even more productive and effective and important to our residents. Thank you.
I really have loved it all. It's been great.
Thank you.
And it's been great working with all you. Thank you.
Is there anything else for the forum tonight? Not hearing anything, I guess we can thank everyone for being here and our legislators, and we'll see you, the legislators, tomorrow night when we will be talking more and more about the budget. And again, thank you, Jason, for your presentation to us. Thanks to Mike and Jim up in the control room, and Marcia Lynch for being here to help us.